All right, we are continuing our study of now Ascension and Pentecost. Ascension and Pentecost. Pentecost is such an exciting feast, and it takes a lot for me to control myself of wanting to jump right up to the end there, the conclusion, which is so beautiful, especially when we look at the typology in the Old Testament. But right now we are in a kind of the pre-Pentecost episodes here in the Exodus story. In the Exodus story. So remember, as the whole point of this Bible study, is that the first Pentecost was not in Acts 2. The first Pentecost was not in Acts chapter 2. Many Christians think of that, if they think of Pentecost at all. They would think of Acts chapter 2 as the first Pentecost. Well, it is the first Christian Pentecost, if you want to speak in that manner. But the first Pentecost in the Judeo-Christian tradition occurs at Mount Sinai. Pentecost is an English transliteration of a Greek word, Pentecosti, 50th. Pentecosti imera, 50th day, the 50th day from Passover. Well, when was the first Passover? Well, that was in Egypt, which we're going to look at right now. So in order to understand Pentecost, the first one, and therefore to understand the first Christian Pentecost, we have to understand the first Passover, of which we have already spoken on many occasions, especially as we were in the season of Pascha, or Passover. So we're going to briefly touch on this and move forward, surge forward toward Mount Sinai to prepare ourselves for our study of Pentecost, the first one at Sinai next Wednesday. Tonight, we're going to look at Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. Last time we left off with Exodus chapter 11, we heard of the ninth plague and the preparations for the tenth plague. Pharaoh is warned in chapter 11 that this last plague is the last plague. This is going to be the death of the firstborn of Egypt. When we hear this warning, when we hear about this plague coming in chapters 11 and 12, we might, with our Christian sensibility, might be uncomfortable and say, hey, is this, how pro-life is this? Or is this really merciful? Remember back in chapter 4, as we talked about when we began our study, back in chapter 4 of the Exodus, verse 23, God warned Pharaoh through Moses, let my son go, that is Israel, that he may serve me, as opposed to the gods of Egypt. If you refuse to let him go, then I will slay your firstborn son. So this warning was given right up front before any of the signs, the works of Moses, that eventually became plagues, any of these 10 plagues occurred. So each one of these plagues was an act of mercy by God. An act of mercy by God. He could have simply jumped straight to the 10th plague. He could have jumped straight to the slaying of the firstborn of Egypt as soon as Pharaoh refused in chapter 5 to let Israel go. He could have slain the firstborn, but he didn't, because he is a merciful God. He is a loving father, and he loves not only the Israelites that he is trying to get out of Egypt, he also loves the Egyptians for whom he is calling the Israelites. Remember, Abraham was called, Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, for the sake of the nations. That includes Egypt. When we read in chapters 10 and 11 of Genesis, we hear about all the generations that came from from Noah, one of the nations that came that's listed in chapter 10 is the Egyptians. Abraham was called from among the nations, that one man, for the sake of the nations, that through his seed, through him, all the nations might be blessed. Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. And a theme repeated all throughout the Abrahamic narrative, and the most common theme repeated in the New Testament in reference to Abraham. So, all of these plagues that then happen leading up to the firstborn plague, the 10th plague, the final plague, are acts of great mercy by God. He starts out by sending, turning water into blood and sending frogs upon the dirt, on the earth, okay, and flies. It's pretty low end on the plague scale. But they keep ratcheting up. Each one of these plagues gets more dramatic. Pretty soon, softball hails falling out of the sky and killing people. Boils and infections on their skin. But that's in the latter plagues. The earlier plagues were just gnats. Now, I don't like being bitten by gnats. I remember when I was in Florida. You were outside anytime after sundown, you're dead. Okay, these little things they called the no-see-ums. I grew up in California. We had mosquitoes, okay? They had these things called no-see-ums. As soon as the sun started to go down, as soon as it got dark, they would attack. And you'd be bitten by all these little, it really hurt. People would go run into their cars and everything. You couldn't see them. They're tiny little gnats. Anyway, that's a pretty merciful plague compared to softball hail falling out of the sky and killing people and the livestock. So it ratchets up each time. This is like a parent dealing with their children. God loves the Egyptians, and he wants to save them. You remember, as we saw in Exodus chapter 9, verse 13 through 17, particularly verse 15 and 16, chapter 9, verse 15 and 16, God says to Pharaoh, look, the reason why I've let you live up to this point, I could have just wiped you out if I wanted to, but it was so that my name might be proclaimed throughout the nations, so that all the earth might know who I am, right? Why? Because God wants all the nations, all people, all descendants of Adam to come into relationship with him, because only in doing that can they be saved. Only in that can they have salvation, which is come to the fruition for which they were created, right? To grow up in the image and likeness of their loving Father. As St. Paul says, God desires that all men be saved, 1 Timothy chapter 2, right? All men be saved. He desires that all men be saved. And so the purpose of these plagues is actually for the salvation of the Egyptians and those who will hear of them. But more on that in another study. Chapter 12, the final plague here, Moses is told to tell all the Israelites to take a lamb or a goat. Goats usually get a bad rap in the Bible, and it's usually why people don't read the Bible. But a lamb or a goat, either one, the Passover animal, could be taken from the sheep or the goats. Okay. So, and then they're going to look at it for 3 days, check it out, make sure it's without blemish. And then on the 14th day, verse 6 of this month, the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill the lambs in the evening. Then they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the house in which they eat them. They shall eat the flesh that night, roasted with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They shall eat it. Okay, so they're going to eat this. They're going to take the blood and put it on the doorpost and then eat the flesh. Why? Again, we've talked about this before. But remember, the blood is the sign of life. Think of Genesis chapter 9. Think of Leviticus 17. When they slaughtered an animal and the blood flowed out and they saw the animal fall over unconscious and then eventually dead, they understood that there was some connection between the life and the blood. Now, we know it's because of the oxygen stored in the hemoglobin and the red blood cells, right? That's traveling throughout. But, you know, that was before modern biology. So they understood the basics, and that is when the blood came out of the animal, the life came out of the animal in some sort of a way, right? If you ever lived on a farm, slaughtered you know, sheep, you've seen this before. So when the blood all comes out, the animal falls over, and unconscious, eventually it dies. So they took this blood that would symbolize the life of the animal, and they put it on the doorpost on the lintel. This is the frame of the door. This is a barrier of life that is going to keep the angel of death out. Death on the outside, life is going to remain on the inside. But that's not all. Israel is not just saved from death by the blood of the Lamb. They are saved for something else. God doesn't save you from something, but to save you for something. Right? So what did God save them from? He saved them from death by the blood of this Lamb. And he gave them the flesh of the Lamb so that they might make it out of Egypt, right? So the purpose was not to just simply save them from death, but was to bring them to the promised land. And the first stage of that journey was, of course, Mount Sinai. If they don't eat the flesh of the Lamb, what are they going to eat here? Some unleavened bread and bitter herbs. How long do you think they're going to make it on their journey? Here in California, I don't know if it's popular in other states, but every now and then I see a big Ford, you know, 350 driving around, F-350 with a bumper sticker on the back. The West was not won on salad. Eat beef. It's usually a rancher's truck, right? Well, there's some truth to that. You're not going to go on a big, long journey with all your animals, all your flocks, all the way out of Egypt on some bitter herbs and a piece of bread. So they're going to eat the flesh of the animal, and the flesh is going to sustain them for their journey out of Egypt and into the promised land. First step, of course, to Mount Sinai. And so this happens, of course. Now, this is important for us for a number of reasons, but remember, this is the beginning of the liturgical year for Israel. Look what it says there in chapter 12, verse 1. This is the beginning of the months. This is where Israel, the descendants of Abraham, the people of God, first begin to acquire some sort of an annual cycle of things that's tied to religious festivities, a liturgical calendar. The first of the year for them, the first great feast, is Passover. Passover, for obvious reasons. Pascha, as it's called in the Aramaic. Pascha comes from the Hebrew. Pesach is Hebrew for Passover. And then, because God's going to pass over their house, right? The angel of death will pass over. And then it's called Pascha later on by the Jews, because they spoke Aramaic, not Hebrew, later on. And then that comes into the Greek. So when you're in the New Testament, the word there is Pascha, borrowed from the Aramaic into the Greek. And then, of course, in the English, in the Eastern Church, of course, we still call the feast Pascha. Or, if you want, in English, Passover. Passover. Christians celebrate Passover. Tragically, in English-speaking countries and Germans, you know, we call it Easter often, which is incredibly confusing. But we celebrate Passover every year. If Christians could figure that out, we would do well for ourselves on a number of counts. But anyway, so Passover, and they're to eat it with their sandals on their feet, their staff in their hand, loins girded, right, ready for a journey. You see, the meat is the thing that is going to give them the energy they need to take that journey. All right, and then chapter 12, verse 14 and following, we hear about unleavened bread for 7 days afterwards, an octave, for 8 days. For a total of 8 days, they're going to eat unleavened bread. The first night of the feast was called Passover. And then for another 7 days, just unleavened bread is all they're going to eat. Now, why is that? Often, again, we think, well, I don't know. Jews just don't like yeast, you know? Well, no, that's not it. Jews like yeast, okay? Jews eat yeast. They eat risen bread, raised bread all year around because it tastes good. You ever eaten bread without yeast in it? It's not very tasty. But for one octave, for one brief period out of the year, they eat bread that's kind of tasteless, that is unleavened bread. Why? To remind them of the Passover. So the first night of Passover, they eat the lamb. And today they don't do this. Modern Judaism has nothing to do with ancient Judaism, but that's another topic. So in the, for example, the first century, or maybe we'll go back some midway through the Old Testament, what they were doing every year is they were eating a lamb in their household and taking the blood, put on the doorpost, eat the flesh, and they would talk about the Passover from Egypt. And then they would also eat unleavened bread for 7 days afterwards to remind them of something. And that was how fast God sent them out of there. Look what it says in chapter 12, verse 34. They got kicked out of there so fast the ladies couldn't even let the bread rise. You see that? That's chapter 12, verse 34. You also see it in verse 39, a reference to the unleavened bread. Understand that the reason why the Jews eat unleavened bread, first of all, understand they only do it for a brief time of the year. And the only reason is because it's a memorial of how fast God sent them out of Egypt. Okay? So it's really important to understand that. Now, that's the first Passover. And they leave Egypt, and not only do the Israelites go, but a great mixed multitude, chapter 12, verse 38. This is Exodus chapter 12, verse 38. A mixed multitude. Those are Gentiles going out with them. Okay, so that is the Passover, the first Passover. And they leave Egypt. The purpose is to smite the Egyptians with this final plague so they will release the Israelites so Israelites can be free to worship their own God. To worship their own God. If you think the Exodus is about political liberation so the Israelites could have their own land or be a free country, as the Ten Commandments movie has it from Hollywood, you got another thing coming. You got to go back and read the book, and you'll see that this is not about political liberation as Hollywood wants to portray this. This is about spiritual liberation from the pagan gods of Egypt. This is why it says in chapter 12, look at chapter 12, verse 12, and upon all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. You see that? This is spiritual warfare, not political warfare. All right. That's the Passover. Again, lots to talk about there, and we've talked about it before. We don't have time to look at it in more detail tonight. The purpose of that is to push forward now, spring forward from there toward the ascension of Moses and the descent of the law for the Israelites. So in chapter 12 through 19, we hear about various episodes, and I will just be skimming here to give you the highlights. In chapter 13, God says to the Israelites, don't forget what happened to you. It shall be as a law, verse 9, as a mark or a sign on your forehead and on your hands. Again, you get it in verse 16. The law is supposed to be as a mark on your forehead and on your hands. That's the Israelites. That's why they, the idea of the phylacteries of putting a little scroll of the Deuteronomy, putting a little leather pouch, they bind it around their head and on their arms. I don't know if you've ever seen a Jew do this. The idea is that the law must be as like a sign on your forehead and on your hand. This is, by the way, in Revelation chapter 13, when you hear about the mark of the beast, the mark on the forehead, on the hand, right? We're not talking about subcutaneously implanted computer chips or something. It's the law of Rome versus the law of God. Are you going to worship the foreign gods that the Roman Empire is forcing the Christians to worship in Asia Minor in the 90s there? Or are you going to obey the law of God that it says you should worship Yahweh alone? So whose mark do you have on your forehead and on your hand in the book of Revelation? The law of God to be monotheist, or the law of the Roman Empire that's trying to enforce paganism upon the Christians in Asia Minor? More on that in a study of the book of Revelation. We talked about that in our study. If you want more on that in our book of Revelation study, which is posted on the website. Chapter 14 and 15, you hear about the crossing of the Red Sea. They crossed the Red Sea. And this is, you can see in this recreation imagery, there's darkness and then there's light. And then they cross the sea swallows up the wicked, but the Israelites go through on dry land. How do the waters get parted? By the Spirit of God. Remember Genesis chapter 1, the Spirit of God, the Ruach Elohim, was hovering over the waters. And then God said, let there be light. Moses strikes the, or lifts up his rod here, and the water parts, the dry land appears, the Israelites go through on dry land. This is recreation imagery. The word Spirit gets lost in the English. You get wind here. But in the Hebrew text, in Genesis chapter 1, in Genesis chapter 8, in the flood story, when you have the resolution of the flood, and then here, the word here, wind or spirit, it's all the same in the Hebrew, ruach, or in the Greek, pneuma. And this is why the fathers of the church saw, as following the direction of the New Testament authors, that the cross and the Red Sea, the flood, were images of creation, recreation, and therefore prefigured the new creation in baptism. You can see Paul, of course, talking about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, about the cross and the sea, like a new baptism, or an old baptism. And then the Peter in 1 Peter chapter 3 talks about the flood prefiguring baptism. Chapter 15, you have this beautiful song of Moses. And then chapters 16 and 17, the people are hungry. In chapter 16, they come across the sea, and look what happens. Verse 3, they say to Moses and Aaron, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by our flesh pots and ate bread to the full. For you brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly of hunger. So they're yearning for Egypt, the security of Egypt, the food of Egypt. They want to go back. It's often been said, God brought Israel out of Egypt with a strong right hand or strong right arm, but it took the rest of salvation history to get Egypt out of Israel. Right? They want to keep going back. And this is important, as the early Christians saw, as an image of our own life, right? After our baptism, often there's especially early on after our baptism, you might have a yearning for the old ways, for the old days, right? You might get a phone call from an old friend, right? Or something like that. Or you have a memory of how things were before you became a Christian. And you might be tempted to want to go back. And sometimes people do go back. They go right back to Egypt, tragically. But chapter 16 here, we hear about the Israelites going forth, and they're hungry, and they want food. They want flesh and bread, flesh and bread. So he gives them flesh and bread. He gives them quail flesh from the sky, right? From the heavens, from the sky. The quail fall out of the sky, and they eat the meat of the quail, and then they eat the bread from heaven, the stuff that comes out of the sky. What is it? They have no idea. In fact, that's what they call it. They call it manhu, in Hebrew, literally, what that? Okay, a good English translation. What is it? And then that's what they call it. What is it? What is it? We don't know, and we still don't know. Scientists speculate about all sorts of ideas. We have no idea what it was. Whatever the case it was a miracle. Just like the quail flesh, right? Try to feed a couple million people in the desert on quail flesh. Right? There's not a lot of meat on a quail. So there are so many quail falling out of the sky into the camp, and you just pick them up. This is a miracle that God is providing for them in the wilderness. In chapter 17, you hear about them being thirsty, right? After you've eaten, then you want to drink something. And so where are they? Remember, they're at the top of the Sinai Peninsula. God doesn't want them to stay there in the top of the Sinai Peninsula. He wants to get them down to the southern point where Mount Sinai is to give them the law. So rather than give them water right there, which would cause them to remain, you're not going to get them away from the water. He has Moses and elders go to the foot of Mount Sinai and strike a rock at the foot of Mount Sinai. And then the water flows up to the camp north. And then they follow the river of living water to its source, right? This is why in the New Testament, well, even later on in the Old Testament, we constantly hear about the law. The Word of God is a source of living water, of running water. This is what Jesus says, of course, remember, to the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4 and many other examples. All right, so then in chapter 18, look at this. What God said in Exodus 9:16 has worked. Exodus 9:16, for this purpose I have let you live, that my name may be proclaimed throughout all the earth. Look at chapter 18, verse 1. Jethro, priest of Midian, heard all that God had done. Verse 11, now I know that Yahweh is greater than all their gods because he delivered the people from the hand of the Egyptians, right? He's obviously more powerful than the Egyptian gods. So he's the God to be feared. As you can see, the purpose of the Exodus already working, already, it's already the blessing of Abraham upon the nations is already beginning, right? You already have a great mixed multitude going out of Egypt with them. You now have the nations hearing about the great works of the God of Abraham. All right, and then now we come to chapter 19. Chapter 19, which brings us a little closer to our purpose now. The people of Israel have arrived at Mount Sinai. They follow the river of living water. Living water in Hebrew, it's a Semitism, meaning running water, moving water. For the Hebrew, if something moved, it was alive. It didn't move, it wasn't alive. And so if water's running, moving, it means living water. They call it living water. And we have idioms like that even in English, right? We say running water, right? Does it have legs? Well, no, it's running. So living water. Chapter 19, they have arrived at Mount Sinai on the third new moon after the people of Israel had gone forth out of the land of Egypt. On that day, they came to the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim and came to the wilderness of Sinai, they camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped before the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel. A little note there on Semitic style, that is called synonymous parallelism. Often people will hear in poetry in the Old Testament, and you get in the New Testament too in places, this Hebrew literary device, something we said twice, sometimes three, four times, it's the exact same thing over and over, but it's said in different ways. We like rhyme. When we want to do poetry, we do rhyme. That's your basic go-to mechanism to indicate you want to do poetry. But in Hebrew, their most common mechanism, and they had rhyme, they had rhythm, all that stuff, but their favorite one was what's called synonymous parallelism. Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, tell the people of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore them you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my own possession and all the people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, holy in Hebrew, kadosh, set apart. God does not set something apart just simply so it can be set apart. Abraham was set apart. He was called forth for the sake of those for whom he was set apart from. And the same thing here. Israel is set apart. They are made holy, set apart for the sake of the other nations. That's also indicated by the word priest. They are a kingdom of priests. What is a priest? A priest is understood in that ancient world as a mediator between the god or the gods and the people. The people ask the priest to pray for them. The priest speaks to God for them. God speaks to the priest, and the priest speaks to the people. It's a prophetic role as well. Israel is called to this role, to be a priestly nation, to be a nation that speaks to God for the other nations, and to be a nation to whom God speaks for the nations. Why? For the sake of the nations from which they were called. that was their calling. They won't actually fulfill it, but that was what they were called to do. Verse 7, so Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered him together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Make a little note for yourself there. Put 24:3. That's a framing device we're going to see in chapters 19 to 24. It's a framing device for the Sinai covenant. All right, so then they're told, be ready, wash, prepare yourselves, for in 3 days I'm coming to you. Get ready. In 3 days I'm coming to you. In 3 days. Why three? Well, three in the Semitic mind was complete, total. If you told someone to get ready for 1 day, well, you'd sort of get ready, right? 2 days, yeah, you're pretty ready. 3 days, you're really ready. Think of the your own experience. Here, some visitors are coming to stay at your house. Well, you got to start cleaning up, right? And so you spend the first day doing the big stuff. Second day, you start finding a few more things. Third day, well, you can polish up things and you're ready. This is why the Israelites requested a 3 days journey out of Egypt. 3 days, complete. We talked about this in the previous studies. By the way, any of you who are logged on who missed those earlier studies, those are recorded and uploaded to the website, so you can go and listen to those. It even says here, chapter 19, verse 15, on the third day, be ready and do not go near your women. Why is that? Well, women are dirty, of course. No. What's going on here? Although it's tragically been read that way sometimes by Christians. They just came out of Egypt. Now, the Israelites, one of their favorite cults of Egypt. They worshiped the Egyptian gods. You know this, right? This is the whole point of the Exodus, is to get them out of Egypt, away from the Egyptian gods, so they can worship the one true God, which is why the first commandment was regarding that. We're going to see them shortly when Moses disappears too long, they're going to worship the golden calf, which is the god Apis, one of the Egyptian cults, and one of their favorite kind of cults, a fertility cult. Fertility cults, I don't think I need to go into detail to explain how their liturgical celebrations went along, but it was not like a modern liturgical celebration. Men and women were involved. Sometimes men and men were involved. Sometimes women and women were involved. All sorts of strange activities. Sometimes animals as well. But these are fertility cults, okay? Fertility cults. Basically an orgy. The people of Israel had come out of Egypt, out of this experience, out of this background. And God warns them about a number of things when they come to Mount Sinai. You are not going to be worshiping me like you worshiped those Egyptian gods. Get that out of your mind right now. And one of the things he has to warn them right up front is that I'm coming to you on the third day. And on that day, don't you dare start some sort of a fertility cult. Okay? All right. Then in chapter 20, God spoke these words to Moses, saying, so Moses is up on the mountain, and he's hearing this stuff. The people are down below. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So why does he have to say that? Well, because this is something they might have wondered about. Remember, the people of Israel had come out of Egypt. They were polytheists. They were pagan polytheists at this point. They had been for 400 years. They had been in Egypt. So the first thing God has to tell them is, I, Yahweh, notice all caps there. That's the divine name. Yahweh, the God of Abraham, is the one who has brought you out of Egypt. That's the first thing. Don't think any other god of Egypt brought you out, or some god of the Canaanites or something. Next, you shall have no other gods before me, therefore, right? I'm the one that saved you. Don't go worshiping one of those other gods. You shall have no other god before me. Verse 4, you shall not make for yourself a graven image of one of those stinking gods and worship it either. Okay, so these first three statements are all anti-pagan polytheism. Modern Christians will read these out of the context of the Exodus and come with all sorts of strange interpretations, especially verse 4. Calvin, unfortunately, went nuts with this and read it as his support for his iconoclasm. Look at verse 5 and 6. Again, this is all verses 1 all the way through 6 are all statements of monotheism versus polytheism. You're going to worship the one true God, and you're not going to worship those stinking pagan gods from Egypt. And you better not make a statue or an image of one of them. It's not, by the way, condemnation of religious imagery. Otherwise, you have a schizophrenic God, because in chapter 25, he's going to command him to make golden angels sitting on top of the ark upon which God's going to rest, right? So, and you know the rest of the temple that Solomon builds and the sanctuary Moses filled with religious imagery. So what this is a condemnation of idolatry. Idolatry. In fact, the very word there in verse 4, graven image, is a bad translation. That is a result of Calvin right there. That is Calvin's influence. Graven image, graven, is an old English word, means carved. Carved image. So let's just translate it. Let's put it in modern English. You shall not make for yourself a carved image. Well, there's a problem. You're going to have in chapter 25, God commanding Moses to carve images and put them on top of the ark, in which the Ten Commandments, these very commandments, are going to be held. Right? So there's a problem there. So what's the Hebrew? The Hebrew word is pesel. It's image. Image. But pesel in Hebrew gets used in the Hebrew Bible universally, not to refer to just image in general. They have lots of words for image. But this word is used to refer to pagan idols, every single occurrence of pesel in the Old Testament, pagan idols, which is why it's translated into the Greek by the Jews 200 years before Christ with the Greek word idolon, idolon, from which we get our English word idol. Right? All right, so better translation there, verse 4, which I've seen, thank God, in some modern English translations, even some Protestant ones, I've seen the word idol there. Is it the NIV or the New English Translation? I don't know. Does it? Very nice. Verse 4, they'll put, you shall not make for yourself an idol. Okay, fine. Now it's clear what it says. All right. So this, you know the rest of the commandments here. We don't need to go into them in detail. The commandments are given here. These are the Ten Commandments. And then in chapters 21 and 22, you get kind of a filling out, kind of the fine print. The application of these Ten Commandments. You shall not steal. Well, then later on we hear that, you know, if you run over your brother's ox with your SUV in the camp, you got to replace it. Otherwise, you're stealing. So there's kind of the fine print, the explanation of things. In chapter 23, we come to a very important passage for us, for our topic, and that is chapter 23, verse 14. Three times in the year, you shall keep a feast to me. Three times in the year, you shall keep a feast to me. Make a little note for yourself there to Deuteronomy 16, where you get this in a little more detail. Deuteronomy 16, okay? So we're looking at Exodus chapter 23, verse 14. Three times in the year, you shall keep a feast to me. But make a note for yourself in your Bibles to Deuteronomy 16, where this, what I'm going to explain to you right now, is explained, okay? Deuteronomy 16 and Exodus chapter 23, verse 14, give us the details of the origin of the liturgical cycle for ancient Israel. And this is important for us because this is, in many ways, the liturgical cycle that the early church inherits. Not because the early church were a bunch of Judaizers, but because very important salvific events in the life of Jesus occurred that corresponded to these events. And there's reasons why, of course. We'll get to those. But look at verse 14 here. Exodus chapter 23, verse 14. Three times a year shall keep a feast to me. We hear about the three great feasts of Israel. The first feast, the Passover. The second feast, Pentecost. Third feast, Tabernacles. Okay? Now, these were originally harvest feasts. These are agrarian feasts. At the beginning of the barley harvest, which is in late spring, this is when the Israelites were brought out of Egypt. So every year when they begin to harvest their barley, when they first put the sickle to the barley, they remember that God harvested them from among the nations and put them in his barn. He took them and set them apart. It was a new springtime. It's the beginning of their nation, the beginning of their history. Very important for them. Okay? Now, more on that later. 50 days later, after the Passover, where were they? At Mount Sinai. Now, what's going on in the agrarian world at this point? As we see here, it's the end of the harvest of the field. After the workers finish harvesting barley, now you're into early midsummer. The wheat is now white. It's ready to be harvested. So the barley harvesters would finish harvesting the barley, put it in the barns, thresh it out, and then they would go to the wheat. And they start harvesting the wheat. By midsummer, depending on the time of year, they were finished with the grain harvest, right? The wheat harvest being the tail end of it. That was midsummer, early midsummer, depending on the how much rain in the season that year, you know? That's what time of year we are in right now, right? This is Pentecost. This is the time of year. If you look outside, depending on where you live, if you live in ancient Israel or you live in California, you look out, the hills are all brown now. This is the time to finish harvesting your grain. You harvest it. You don't want to harvest when it's green. It'll mold on you. Okay, so then the third major feast is the Feast of Tabernacles. And we're not going to look at that right now. That's for another study. And we've talked about this. We already talked about the festal cycle of Israel. So if this is really exciting stuff for you, if you've never heard this stuff before, there is a study we already did, Early Christian Prayer and the Festal Cycle of Israel. And it's on our website. It's recorded there for you, so you can go back and listen to that. But for tonight, what we're looking at, we're preparing ourselves for the Feast of Pentecost to understand what we're going to celebrate this Sunday and to appreciate it as the early Christians did. The first Pentecost for Israel was at Mount Sinai, 50 days after the Passover, right? Pentecosti imeta, the 50th day. They're at Mount Sinai, and what did they receive? They received the law. How did they receive it? Did they show up at Mount Sinai, and suddenly it just fell out of the sky? No, it was on stone tablets. That would hurt. So they were at the foot of the mountain, and what happened? Did the Ten Commandments on stone tablets come tumbling down? How did they get the Ten Commandments? How did they get the covenant? Moses, the mediator of the covenant, who had freed them from Egypt through the Passover, went up that mountain for them, which is what happened for us in the Passover of Jesus, who freed us from Egypt and went up that mountain for us to bring down the law, bring down the word of God and put it not on stone tablets, but in the tablets of our heart. Jeremiah chapter 31. So chapter 23 of the Exodus tells us about these three feasts. The one we're interested in right now is then this Feast of Pentecost. We've already talked about the Passover. We've already talked about Tabernacles. And we've talked about all these feasts before in other studies. But I want to focus tonight as we conclude here and next week as we finish off our study of Pentecost about the events surrounding the first Pentecost. The people of Israel have come to Mount Sinai. And they have Moses has gone up the mountain. And Moses, while he's up on the mountain, is given the word of God, the law. He's given the law. And then What's going to happen? He's going to deliver it to the people. He's going to deliver it to the people. Now, you can read, we'll read just briefly about that in chapter 24. Look what happens here. Chapter 24. And he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70, the elders of Israel, worship. Moses alone shall come near. Verse 3, Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord. Remember that language we heard back in chapter 19? All the words of the Lord. And all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, this is chapter 24, verse 3, all the Lord, the words of the Lord has spoken, we will do. That's a framing device. Remember, chapter, you can make a little note for yourself now, put 19, verse 8, 19, colon 8, to remind yourself of this framing device, a literary framing device for the Sinai covenant. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord. And he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings to the oxen of the Lord. And Moses took half the blood, put it in the basins, half the blood, threw it against the altar. Then he took the blood, the book of the covenant, and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord Yahweh, the God of Abraham, has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. And Moses took the blood and threw it upon the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant. And they had a meal. Okay, so a couple really important things to notice there to prepare us for next week. When they hear the word of the Lord, when they hear the commandments, Moses has brought them down. What happens? They accept the word. The blood of the covenant is splashed on them and on the altar. Kind of messy. Why would you do this? You're standing there. Remember, they had taken a shower or a bath. 3 days they had washed themselves. Can you imagine? You're standing there with your wife and, you know, and 10 kids at Mount Sinai in your Sunday best or your Sabbath best now. And all of a sudden, Moses are splashing blood all over you. And this is without any seltzer water. How are you going to get it out? They didn't want to get it out. This is the blood of the covenant. They were covered in the blood of the covenant. A sign by its blood on them and on the altar that they were now in communion with God. One family reunited to God, their Father. And if God is their Father and they have come back into communion with Him, Adam and Eve have entered back into the garden and God will dwell with man. And that's what we see here then in chapter 24. They eat a meal in His presence. And in chapter 25, they get the descriptions, verse 8, of how God might dwell among them. That's salvation, my friends. Salvation is not you flying up into the heavens to escape from this world. Salvation is God coming to dwell among man. That was the plan when He first created Adam and Eve in the garden. That was what we see reinstituted in chapter 25 of the Exodus when the people have agreed to obey His commands. They are now one family again, going together, eating a meal together. Who does this? A family. And God says, make me a sanctuary, chapter 25, verse 8, that I may dwell in their midst. Now, does it last for an all? They mess up. You know the story. But then they agree again to keep His commandments, and God comes to dwell among them. You can read about this in 1 Kings chapter 6. He will come and dwell among them in the temple Solomon will build. The purpose of the tabernacle that Moses built, the purpose of the temple, and these are places that purpose is sacrifice. This isn't the purpose of that place. The purpose of those places is that God may dwell among His people. And yes, they will offer sacrifice because that's where God dwells among them. But the purpose is that He may dwell among them. This is salvation. And this is critical to understand. If we're going to understand the first Pentecost of the new covenant in Acts chapter 2, if we don't understand the relationship of the story of the Garden of Eden to the story of the Exodus here that we just read about, then we can't have any hope to understand what God is doing when He restores man to communion with him through his eternal Son, when he refashions him, as St. Paul says in Romans chapter 8, into his image and likeness again. More on that next week.